You and I with Rashmi Shetty is a simple attempt of bringing in stories of people you and I can draw inspiration from. Ordinary folks, extraordinary lives, their uniqueness and individuality that make them interesting to talk to and to listen to. A reaffirmation of the fact, open your eyes wider, the world is far more beautiful when we acknowledge the presence of both you and I. April 2nd is World Autism Awareness Day, and we have a special guest on You and I with Rashmi Shetty. We are Firoz, corporate honcho, best-selling author, columnist, and founder of the India Inclusion Foundation. He tells us about a role he is blessed to play, that of an inspired dad to Vivan, who is on the autism spectrum. He shares why awareness is important for parents and what beautiful lessons 12-year-old Vivan has taught him over the years about life and living. Hi Firoz, welcome to You and I with Rashmi Shetty. It's such an honor and privilege to have you on the show. Now let me describe all the titles I have of Firoz. We are Firoz, Senior VP SAP, author of bestsellers and a national bestseller in Gifted, founder of the India Inclusion Foundation. This is what the world knows, the corporate world knows. What I know of Firoz, a loving husband, a positive human being, a dependable friend, and an inspired dad. All these titles put together, if I throw them in front of you and ask you to pick a card of your choice, that would be the card we're going to explore today. So which one do you want to pick?
Firstly, thank you for that very kind introduction. I must confess, I get very embarrassed with all these flowery terms. And I keep saying that I wish my mom and dad listens to all these lovely introductions, because I think my father will feel very proud. My mother will actually believe everything you said, Rashmi. And I really want my wife to hear all of that as well. But, you know, thank you for that. Firstly, I'm delighted to be part of your podcast. I very fondly remember, I think my first radio show was with you almost a decade ago. Yeah. And it still has such fond memories. So firstly, thank you for inviting me to be part of your show. You know, of all the things that you said, I think I've probably done most interviews where the focus is really on my corporate journey. And maybe a lot of them are also about the India Inclusion Foundation, which I started. So maybe I'd love to explore the dad side of it, because nobody has ever asked me that. And that's I think there's a lot to share there as well. So I'll probably explore the dad side, Rashmi, if that is interesting to you and to the listeners.
Definitely, Firoz, because I too am curious on that side, because I'm sure a lot has shifted for you ever since the pandemic struck. So yeah. How has the pandemic treated you?
It's such a very profound question. I think let's not underestimate the fact that the pandemic has really been hard on every person. Having said that, I think many of us, and me specifically, has been very fortunate that we can still do a lot of things being at home. And there's a beautiful, you know, the work from home has been like the thing that everybody's talking about right now. And I think we should never forget that work and home itself are great blessings. So I say, if you have work and if you have a home, I think that's a great blessing itself. And so people like you and me have been fortunate to have both of that. So I think we should not underestimate that many of us have been incredibly fortunate during these hard times to have the two basic things that is required for our survival. So having said that, I think the silver lining for me personally has been the time that I've got with family. And I think I not just told you, but many others, that if I had a wish list, say a year ago, and it would have to be that I hope I don't have to get into a flight ever again, right? I mean, I was sick and tired of going to the airport, traveling around the world. And here it is that I haven't been to an airport for a year, which meant that I've been more at home. Actually, being in the US, where the pandemic has really decimated the society, we've been in the house for a year. So it's been a blessing in disguise that I could spend the time that I got both with Vivan and Dipali in absolutely uninterrupted ways. And now actually I fear, and I think Dipali is the one who keeps saying, I wish you don't go back to office ever again. So quality time with family has been, is just unbelievable what we've got in return for the pandemic.
Okay, and any new skills? Everyone picked up new skills.
I think the skill that I never thought I will be speaking about, not in a podcast, is that I've learned dishwashing, Rashmi. I've learned cooking a lot more. And I think YouTube has probably the greatest learning platform ever, you know. If you want to cook a new dish, you go to YouTube and learn it. So cooking and dishwashing, Rashmi, are new skills that I think I've learned. I think it's meditative, you know. It calms you down. It allows you to focus. I don't know whether I can say this 1 year from now, but at least now it seems very meditative.
We'll catch up then for sure. I would love to. And of all the cards, Feroz, you said you'll pick the one of the inspired dad. And at that point, what came to my mind was a quote, children learn more from what you are than what you teach.
Beautiful.
So when we are talking about what you teach to who you are, let's start from that defining moment as a parent for you, when everything went your way till a certain point in life. So can you step back a little and take us on that journey?
Yeah, I think this is it's an emotional question, because it kind of takes me back to 2010, almost 10 years ago. And like you said, I think I was just riding on this incredibly so-called successful wave of, you know, having done well in my career, married Dipali, who was my college sweetheart. You know, I started dating Dipali when I was probably 18 years old. Didn't really have a clue what it is, what love, life is all about. And then to eventually get married, you know, when all the things go in your favor, I think you do develop a sense of arrogance and the feeling that, you know, nothing can go wrong. And that's when Vivan was diagnosed with autism. And, you know, that broke my heart. That got through very tough moments of even going through a phase of denial and depression. I think that was by far the hardest phase of my life. But I think when I look back, I came out of it very quickly. My wife Dipali came out of it even faster. I think for her, it never really mattered. It was like, okay, now Vivana has autism, let's figure out what to do. But it took me a lot longer to really deal with that idea. And I think it came from a fundamental belief that, you know, as engineers, we always look for fixing things. I took a lot of pride in seeing myself as, you give me a problem and I'll solve it. You know, I was always a problem solver in my mind, whether at work or anywhere else. You just tell me something, I want to find a fix for it. And I think I went on this journey of trying to say, I have to fix Vivan. I have to find a solution for all his challenges. And that made me even more, I would say, sad and disappointed, because I realized slowly that, you know, not everything can be fixed. And that's a very humbling experience, if you lived a whole life taking pride in solving things. And suddenly you said, you know what, some things you can't solve. And very quickly I realized that Vivan is autistic for life. And I was in that journey of trying to change him, trying to fix him. But once I realized that he is who is, and I have to just love him unconditionally, and just take one day at a time and do the best we can, I started relishing him and life a lot more. So I think the big shift is trying to find a solution to saying, trying to live life with a lot of love, and love which is unconditional. And that's the hard part. I think, you know, they say, right, marriage changes you, but a child can transform you. That's incredibly profound, that all the changes that happened in my life, the real big ones, and really understanding life very deeply happened after Vivan's diagnosis. And the idea that you have to love people unconditionally, only a child can teach you.
When you are talking this journey, I'm sure walking on that road itself must have reopened a lot of moments for you.
Yeah.
Did this journey in any way help you win that award with the World Economic Forum as well?
Probably it did. As I said, what Vivan gave me, and I think the greatest gift, is a sense of purpose. And my mentor, Kiran Bedi, actually played a huge role in realizing that purpose for me. I think everybody has a purpose. It's just that most of us just don't see it or don't recognize it. And she said something very profound, and when she said, Firoz, most people live their whole life without finding what the purpose is. You're incredibly fortunate the purpose found you. Right? And for me, the fact that my understanding of the disability space, there was no way I would have, I would have done something meaningful probably, but disability, there was no connection. So in many ways, it forced me to understand the space, forced me to contribute and give back to the community, because I think I'm very fortunate that I can not just take care of Ivan, but also in a position where I can hopefully give back. So, I found a purpose for life. It was not a temporary purpose. It was not something that I said, I'll do it for 5 years and then I'll move on to something else. I think this is a mission for life. And when, real impact happens when you've done something for a very long period of time, right? And so to be able to ground yourself in meaning and purpose wouldn't have happened without Vivan at all. So I would say all the good things that happened since then has been very grounded in that understanding of what your core purpose is. And, there's nobody other than Vivan to give credit for that.
Firoz, I know where you're coming from when you're saying this, but was the diagnosis the reason why you went into researching what it is all about and
yes.
saw how it can be used in your
yes.
space of work? And that's where this entire project came in, where you made it sustainable. Was that
yes.
the challenge? What's that the
drive?
What was it?
Yeah, so, I'm talking about 2010, Rashmi, where, disability was seen as a taboo. Autism was completely unknown. Autism was not even one of the disabilities in the Disability Act. There were only 7 disabilities, and autism was not even included there. Hmm. So, obviously, not too many people knew about it. And I just dug deep into it, trying to understand the space. I watched every TED talk, I met every thought leader in the autism space, because I really wanted to understand what does the life ahead look for me. Mm-hmm. Really, and what I didn't realize at that point was very subtly I was trying to understand Vivan, and at that time we assumed that he will be able to speak and express himself, but he's now 12 years old, he's nonverbal. And if somebody asked me, what is the one, if you had a magic wand, what would you want that magic wand to do? And now I can tell you the only thing that I would want is to understand him better. Today, I don't know what he's thinking. Today, I don't know what he's going through. If he has a tantrum, for example, I really don't know. Is it because he has a stomachache? Is it because he has pain somewhere? Is it because we just don't understand him? We have no understanding of that. So I often wonder what's going in his mind, because he's nonverbal, can't express himself. He's able to do that a little bit now by, pointing at alphabets and spelling out things. But if I had a magic wand, I would say, help me understand him. Because for him, it's incredibly frustrating that he's not able to express himself. I think that is the root cause of his tantrums and his challenges. Even after all of that, he's an incredibly happy kid. He's such a joy. He's always smiling. And I think I never realized how resilient children are. You know, he has tons of medicines. He has, you know, a lot of health issues, but he's always smiling. And I have no clue. Like, I'm like, how does this kid always smile, you know, even with all these challenges? So we sometimes underestimate how resilient children are. But yes, you know, all the research that I did, and I'm still doing, this is still work in progress, as I said, is just so that I can understand him better. And of course, in the process, I understand the community better. I understand what parents go through. I understand the needs of people a lot better. But, you know, he's in many ways the path to opening this massive world, which is, as I said, I'm still exploring.
And, you know, when the diagnosis is done, children are usually put in a particular spectrum. They say from this end of the spectrum to that.
Yeah.
So there won't be a uniform way each one reacts, right? So how did you pick up how you communicate with them? How did you
I think, you know, we were lucky that he was diagnosed very early. So he was 18 months when he was diagnosed. And at that time, we really didn't know how it would span out, right? You know, they normally say he's, you know, high functional, low functional, you know, they kind of categorize that way. And we had no way. And we assumed that he will be able to communicate and speak. But the reality is, for all practical purposes, is fully dependent on us. So, for example, basic things like brushing his teeth and cleaning him and giving him a bath, and even feeding him, he can't do on his own. So everything, every activity is something that we have to support him. Of course, our hope is that he eventually becomes independent, at least for his basic living. So we've kind of learned as we go how to deal with it. But it's a small step. You just hope that the next day is better than the previous day, right? You just hope that 5 years from now, he's in a much better situation than what he is today. But what I've realized is you can't rush it in. You have really no control. If you ask me what's the one thing that I have learned the most is humility, right? It really humbles you. You know, as I said, sometimes a position and power gives you a false sense of control. Right? You believe that when you're heading a large organization, you can control the outcome. You can decide who does what. When I was researching about the word humility itself, I realized that you become humble when you realize that you are never in control. Mm-hmm. You know, arrogance happens when you believe you are in control. And I realized that there's really nothing much I can control except my response to his condition. That's the only thing you can control. The outcomes are not in your hands. So I think that has been the greatest learning. It's humbled me incredibly. I think there was a Firoz before Vivan, and there is a Firoz after Vivan. I think it's clearly made me, hopefully, a much better person.
Powerful, Firoz, because this is where we segue into the next question, which is a lot of patience and a lot of patience that you have to build. What has he taught you there, and how has he helped you build both of these?
You know, I don't want to undermine that it is hard. Yeah, you know, I don't want to say this is all looks great and it's perfect. It is not. It is a struggle every day. It is hard every day because, you know, 24/7 you are on your, you know, always looking out and thinking about it. So it's hard. Let's not make it sound that it is easy. But really, if I have to take one great lesson, is that, you know, pain is inevitable, but suffering is optional. And in many ways, the choice that frees us or imprisons us is the choice between love and fear. Okay. Now, I'll tell you what every parent, in fact, I got a mail yesterday from a parent who was asking me, so Firoz, you know, I'm worried what will happen to my child after I'm gone. And this is a common question for every parent, right? And so what do you suggest? And I really said, I don't have the answers. I'm searching myself. But what I've really seen is that that's the lens of fear. that's the lens you see the world, like what will happen after 10 years. You're worried, and that's the lens of fear. And I said, if you turn that around and see from the lens of love, I think life will become much more meaningful. So it's a very hard shift to make, to see the world from the lens of love and not from the lens of fear. And I'm not saying that it has to be grounded in action. You still have to do things what you have to do. But I think the ability to see the world from a position of love is probably the biggest thing that, for me, I've kind of learned over many years. And, you know, one of my mentors is Gary Zukav, who wrote this beautiful book called Seat of the Soul. And his next book is now called The Universal Human. He's an incredible intellect. And he said, you know, he's a physicist to start with. He went to Harvard, wrote this book called The Dancing Woolly Masters, which is about quantum physics. And he said, you know, Firoz, life is like physics. For every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. You will get more love from the world if you put more love into the world. It's as simple as that. And I'm like, oh shit, I never thought about it. Right? And it's actually incredibly profound. So I've got, you know, the one thing that I've learned is just put more love into it. That's it. And then the world will conspire in beautiful ways. And so you stop worrying about things and you say, you know, I'm going to just put more and more and more love into the world, through Virvan, through the world, and you get back in ways just unbelievable. It's just unbelievable. I'll tell you this, and I don't know whether, you know, a lot of people say this is physics. Sometimes you think it's serendipity. You know, for many months, we've been, you know, he's on some severe medication because he also has Crohn's disease, which is an autoimmune disease. And he says medications are pretty severe. And we've been saying, let's try something Ayurvedic, for example. You know, you're not pumping in so much medicines into his body, maybe something more natural. And so me and my wife are saying, okay, maybe when we go to Kerala next time, we'll take him to an Ayurvedic doctor and see what is the treatment we can give him. But, you know, then the lockdown happened and I'm like, okay, this is not going to happen for the next maybe 1 or 2 years. Guess what? I get connected randomly by a friend to another person and we start talking and he says, Firoz, you know what? I have a friend who's the best Ayurvedic doctor in the US. He's from Kerala, by the way. After the conversation, connected me to the doctor. He put an appointment with him and he even paid for the whole treatment. Absolutely random person. Of course, I know him a lot better now, but this is the first meeting. Why would somebody come and pay for a treatment? And I was feeling, you know, I was telling him, you know, please don't do this. I can pay. You know, why don't you just pay for somebody else? And he says, Firoz, no, I'm not paying to you. I'm doing this for Vivan. He's the enlightened soul and I'm doing it for him. And then you look back and say, how did the world know that I was looking for an Ayurvedic doctor and I was in my mind thinking, oh, I have to postpone this for the next 2 years until, you know, the world opens up. And here I am getting the best Ayurvedic doctor from Kerala in the US, fully paid by an unknown person. And that's when I really started feeling the power of just putting love out there. It is not transactional. It is not where I give you something and I get it back in return. You know, the world is so beautifully interconnected. And this is not once in a while, Rashmi. This has happened time and again. And when I tell this to people, they're like, ah, no, you're kind of thinking too much into this. You know, and I really started believing that intentions have infinite organizing capacity.
I believe in that completely. When you were talking about the Ayurvedic doctor who you found, in fact, who found you in the US and who you went to, did his treatment help Vivan? Did it reduce the medications that he was on and help him in any which way?
So the funny thing is, because of the current restrictions, I couldn't fly to meet him. And he's a doctor who needs to feel his pulse. But he said, you know what? We did like a Zoom call and we've already started. It's been 6 months that his treatment has started. Of course, hopefully we'll go and meet him when things open up. But, you know, that's the best we could do in this situation, that you can start him on a treatment. But the process is pretty slow, right? I mean, it takes time. But I'm glad that, you know, one of that wishes has been fulfilled. And as a parent, you can only say, you know, these are things I would love to do and I hope I'm able to do that. So you know, the medications are still going on, and I hope it is useful for him.
So here, when you spoke about as a parent building a relationship where communication is a challenge, understanding is a challenge, how do you build that positive, beautiful relationship, not only with the child, but also with each other as parents? What are your strategies? Yeah. What have you learned?
So, you know, one thing I've very, very quickly realized is this is like a team sport, right? And I've seen that a special needs child can really break relationships. And in fact, there's statistics to show that most relationships suffer because of this, because, you know, it puts in so much of stress into the relationship that more often than not, relationships actually don't work. And maybe I was very fortunate that me and Dipali go back almost now 25 years, that in many ways Vivad's condition has made the relationship much more stronger. And the only reason is we both have the same goal, right? Before Vivan happened, you know, I was following my career and she was following her career. And, you know, there was, I think with Vivan, both converged to the same mission. And so it doesn't really matter. We both are seeing the world from the same final outcome. So in that way, I think it has strengthened our relationships, even though, you know, of course, if you ask Dipali, you'll get a different version. She'll still complain that I'm not spending enough time with her and all of that. But I think keeping that aside, the fact that both of us have the same mission makes a big difference in strengthening the relationship. And the other thing is, we've realized that even though Vivan doesn't speak, he understands everything. So if me and Dipali have a fight, you know, that's really bad for him. So, you know, our biggest challenge is really to find time to fight now, because we don't want to fight in front of him. And so he gets affected by that. You know, the energy, somehow he figures it out. So we're just not finding time to fight. I think that's our biggest complaint right now. Yeah.
Okay, you're a father. I'm not too sure whether you're going to be biased in the next question. Primary caregivers for children,
yeah,
special needs or otherwise, are mothers, is how it is normally perceived. Okay, no, yeah, unconscious, yeah, bias here. This is how it is perceived. Now, yeah, as a father, what, yeah, is it that since the last 1 year you are at home and you're seeing everything that's happening, if you were given a choice to change anything going back,
yeah,
is there something in your role as a father you would have altered or changed to make it easy on Dipali, or you think you've done your best?
I think, Rashmi, this is a very loaded question, and I don't know if my answer will hurt all the women listeners. I understand that, you know, there's no doubt that the mothers are the primary caregivers. But I think fathers can be equal partners too, and they should. You know, I don't claim that I was an equal partner before COVID. I don't think I was. In fact, my wife used to call me an absentee father for a very long time. And that's true as well. As I said, I was traveling 50% of the time. I didn't do as much as I should. So there is, you know, there's no denying that mothers are the primary caregivers. But I think fathers have an equal role from a child's perspective, right? And I think a child needs a father as much as a mother. And maybe the, you know, the situations have forced fathers to maybe introspect and do more. As I said, COVID has been a blessing in disguise, because I've been able to do more. I've got more time. And that's not an excuse at all, but I think I was able to do a lot more for him. And more than doing for him, I'm enjoying this. And I don't want to make it grand, like, you know, I'm now doing something for my son. It, you know, this is, as I said, the greatest joy, to be able to spend time in a meaningful manner with him. I'll tell you the funny situations. For example, you know, all of, he's in grade 6 now. And so all of his classes, one of us have to sit through. Okay, so if he's on a Zoom class, he'll not sit on his own. So we've kind of said, okay, you sit for some classes, I'll sit for some of his classes. So I kind of shift from doing a board meeting 1 hour, and the next hour I'm sitting in grade 6 sitting with all his classmates. And the most funny thing is to be part of his physical training class. So he has a PT class, you know, every Monday and Thursday in the morning. And I'm supposed to do all this, you know, PT sessions with him. And it's funny, he will not do anything. And I'm the one who's doing the push-ups. He's sitting and looking at me and kind of saying, yeah, you better do your push-up properly. And I'm like, this is for you. This is not my PT class, right? So there are a lot of these funny situations. I would have never imagined that I would be actually sitting with him in a classroom if COVID had not happened. We had, in many ways, Rashmi, outsourced education to the schools and teachers. We said, you know, I will send my child to the school and wash my hands off and I'm done. In our case, that's not an option because I can't allow him to just sit on a Zoom because he will not sit, number one. And but so in many ways, we've learned the learning process, the education system being with him now. It's an incredible hustle in the sense that, you know, you have to do school and cooking and dishwashing and your office work. But I think we've become now equal partners in the education of our children. Otherwise, you know, it was an yearly affair, right? Okay, you get your once a year, they have a parent-teacher meeting and you go and you show up and that's a big deal. But now, no, it's a day-to-day activity. You have to spend time with them in their class every day, at least in my case. So I have understood the education system so much more better. And I think more than anything else, I have started valuing teachers more than anything ever before. You know, they say, right, great societies are built on the foundation of great teachers. I think COVID has allowed us to value that a lot more. There's no doubt. I think the best teachers have to be the best paid in the world, not technologists, not tech companies, not at all. I mean, you know, technology is just a tool, but teachers teach values, and that's priceless. And sometimes I just don't understand why are teachers not paid well enough. I think that's the one big thing I will be fighting for in the future, hopefully, that really to give the space and make teachers the center of our society and our communities. It's so important. And I think COVID taught me that.
On the flip side, who's performing better? I'm not asking you about your school, but is Papa scoring better or Mama?
I think Mother, hands down. I mean, she's so committed. I'm incredibly lazy. I don't do the homeworks, for example, on time, Rashmi. I'm always late for doing the homework, right? She's so particular. You know, you have to, you know, upload the Zoom, in the Zoom, the classes, the homeworks. I'm still very lazy and not perfectionist at all when it comes to his homework. So I'm not doing well at all, but I'm trying. I'm still work in progress.
Okay, you're giving yourself too much time or leeway in this process. Feroz, does your research anywhere tell you that the presence of a sibling can alter it for the child at home?
Oh yeah, I mean all the time. So I think it's not about siblings, it's about relationship. And I'll give you two specific insights into what I mean by relationships. Now, there was this Harvard case study done, which said that the average life of a person increases by between 3 to 5 years just by having your children or your grandchildren around you. That's it. You don't need any medication. Okay? Which means that if you have your grandchildren in the circumference of maybe say 10 kilometers, your life increases by 5 years. What does that mean? It just means that we are deeply social animals. And the only thing that matters is your relationship. That's it. For me, that has been a great learning. And I'll tell you how. When I was young, you know, I was always thinking that your success is basically 90% effort and 10% relationship, right? You know, we were taught, right? You work hard, you get your degrees, and then you will get a good job, and then you will do well. And, you know, we were all wired to think that way. And yeah, maybe somewhere you work on your relationship. It's actually the exact opposite. My learning is life and success, or whatever you call that, is actually 90% relationship and 10% effort. That's a big flip that has happened to me in the last maybe 4 or 5 years, that the only thing that is that determines your long-term success is what is the relationships you build around you. So when you asked about having a sibling, it's not about a sibling. It's just about, are you having close relationships? And it, you know, sibling is just one form of that relationship, right? So I believe that the core is human relationships, and, you know, how you build those relationships will determine who you become eventually.
Well said. And your shift from India to the US, has it been something that you're really happy about in handling education?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, I think US is at least 10, 20 years ahead in terms of just the awareness, the infrastructure that you have, especially for special needs child. And my hope is that I'm very fortunate that I can move to the US. I can get a lot of things for Vivad. And my mission through the India Inclusion Foundation is to at least provide some of it back in India for people who are less fortunate. So the US move has been just phenomenal. And sometimes we just didn't realize how it affected Vivan. I'll tell you one small example. So we were in India till Vivan was 5 years old. He's now 12, so, you know, 5-6 years old. And one of his biggest challenges was that he was not able to sleep well. Okay. He wouldn't have more than a couple of hours of good sleep every night. He will wake up and cry. And, you know, when people ask me, Firoz, what's your wish? I used to say that I wish my son sleeps through the night, because it basically meant that I didn't sleep or Dipali didn't sleep. And then we used to take turns. We used to say, okay, I'll sleep today, you sleep tomorrow, because Vivan wouldn't get sleep. And guess what? As soon as I moved to the US, he started sleeping well. And I'm like, how did this happen? What is it? And then I realized it was because he was hypersensitive to noise. Okay. And so even though we were living in an apartment complex, which was all nice and beautiful, but there used to be these vehicles going through on the road every day, right? So at 4 o'clock, somebody will open the gate and there will be a noise. And for him, that was a massively amplified sensory that he was getting. So he would just wake up and couldn't go back to sleep. But now where we live in the US, you know, it's an extremely quiet place. And I didn't connect this until later, and I realized, oh wow, this is because he's hypersensitive to any form of noise, and because he's in a calmer place, he's just able to sleep better. And so these are very subtle things that have happened, other than the fact that you get great healthcare, very good schools, the society is very understanding. You know, it's just not even people. You don't even have to explain his condition to anybody. And it also comes because the system trains people at a very young age to accept the special needs child. And I'll tell you this one story that happened. I had gone to fill gas and Vivan was sitting in the back seat. And, you know, I was putting the gas on the car and I didn't realize that Vivan actually opened the door and started walking out. I didn't realize that I was on the other side. And when I came back and I'm like, where's he? And then I found that, you know, one young kid held his hand, was talking to him nicely and, you know, chatting with him, even though he was not responding. You know, I was like panicking and I'm like, and he said, no, I know. And I started to apologize. And I'm like, sorry, and thank you for, you know, taking care of him. And he was like, yeah, but, you know, I've grown up with special needs child in my class and I know his condition. It's not a big deal. And so people are just so much more aware. They're so much more sensitive. That's what happens when you start including people from a very young age, right? And I saw the impact of that, because I didn't have to explain his condition to anyone. Like, yeah, I know he's on the spectrum, doesn't matter. And I know he will not respond to my questions, but that's absolutely fine. I'm chatting with him and they're like buddies talking. And I'm like, wow, how did this happen? He said, I grew up with special needs child. I grew up in an inclusive classroom. And that's the impact that you see.
Yeah, and talking about inclusion, how easy was it for Vivan in school to make friends, become part of a group? Does that happen now? Okay, because of COVID, but pre-COVID days, how does Vivan form his clique in school?
So, yeah, so he, you know, he goes to an inclusive school, but his classroom has mostly all of them are non-verbal autistic kids. But they also have like 20 so-called neurotypical kids will come and spend time with them, right? And I you know, he enjoys going to school. It's amazing that he is actually every day, you know, we feel like, you know, why to wake him at 6 o'clock to catch his bus at 7 o'clock? He's like super happy. He wants to go to school every day, right? So he went to school, but now obviously he got too used to being at home. I hope he wants to go back to school again post-COVID. But I think the misconception that we have is that autistic children or children on the spectrum are non-social. I think that's a misconception. It's not that they don't want to socialize. It's just that because they are unable to, they kind of go in a shell. Right, so you have to change that idea that it's not that they are non-social. It's not that they don't like people. It's just that they're responding to a lot of people, not engaging with them. And if you engage with him, he's fine. He may just not respond, but you know, he's fine. He's hanging around. He's listening to everything. He's having fun. And that doesn't make them non-social. So that's, again, a fundamental shift that I've had, because the common narrative is the autistic children are non-social. I don't think that's true.
And when you talk about non-social or non-communicative, these children are also blessed with amazing talent. Yeah. How do you pick what is that they're specifically good at?
Yeah, I think that's a struggle. That's a journey that I'm still on, and I really don't know. It's too young to figure what he's really good at. But I think the only way is to expose them to as many things as possible, because you don't know what's the one thing that really, what really clicks. I'll tell you one simple story. I think I've shared this before. You know, we tend to assume a lot of things about children, because since they are not able to respond, we assume things. Okay, like, I'm sure Vivan loves blue in color, but no, maybe he loves something else, right? So we parents sometimes underestimate their abilities and want to impose our thinking to them. You know, in his class last week, so he was asked, what do you want to become when you grow up, right? And a lot of us work in terms of options. So we'll say, okay, you want to become a doctor, a lawyer, an astronaut, or whatever. But he also has the ability to point at alphabets and show what he wants. And in my mind, or in Dipali's mind, we were thinking he'll pick one of these traditional stuff, because that's what we've been talking to him about. And he says, I want to know about nature. We tend to underestimate their abilities a lot. You know, one of the things we asked him once was, okay, what's the nickname you want to be called? You know, all kids, we give a nickname, right? So we gave him a nickname, you know, we call him Chungu at home. And so, but we never asked him, what's the nickname you want? So we asked him, Vivan, what is the nickname you would like to have? And we explained what a nickname is. Nickname is what we will call you lovingly. And he typed on the letterboard, MarcoPolo. Marco Polo. And I said, Marco Polo? So I was like, when did he know about Marco Polo? Is this accidental, or did he think about it? So we asked him a follow-up question. Why do you want to be called a Marco Polo? And he says, because I want to explore. So that's when we realized he has so much of thinking in his mind, which we just don't know. Because he's actually, you know, picking up things from listening. Because he's listening to everything that is happening. He's gathering everything that is happening around him. So he's very perceptive. He's listening, he's understanding, he's creating his own image of the world. I remember once asking him, what does he think about, you know, technology? Because he loves to use the, you know, iPad all the time. He's addicted to the devices. And his answer was, you know, technology doesn't create real relationships.
He wrote that answer?
I'm like, he wrote that answer.
Wow.
And I'm like, boy, how does he know this? So those are the things which surprises us every day. And this is, you know, he has to type word by word. So he has to be extremely patient. It takes sometimes 10 minutes to get, you know, one sentence out of him. But the one sentence that we get out of him is like incredibly profound. I'm like, how did he know that, right? So I think we just don't know. We just don't know what they're capable of. And sometimes we limit our kids' abilities by our own abilities.
Very true. You never know what touches them of what they've seen or heard.
Yeah.
For their next moment. That's true. Completely agree with you, of course.
Yeah.
And Now, the three takeaways. The whole thing was you being an inspired dad. So three takeaways. That child is the father of man is what you're going to prove right today. So three lessons that Vivan has taught you over the last 10 years.
There are many, but you know, I'll just categorize them as love, pain, and humility. The first is to really love unconditionally. Right? There are no strings attached, and the idea that the more love you put into the world, the more you get it back. So that's probably the most important lesson I've learned from him, through him. The second is that pain is universal. There's the saying that the human triad, Rashmi, is pain, guilt, and death. This is the human triad. There is not a single person out of the 7 billion people who can escape that. Everybody will have pain. Everybody will have guilt. Everybody will eventually die. But the real insight is that, you know, while pain is universal, suffering is optional. And I think we all go through that suffering phase. But now I've gone through a phase where you don't get frustrated, you know, with things that are not in your control. And my personal insight, and I teach that at Columbia University, is that pain, purpose, and progress are correlated. Because in my lecture at Columbia, and I teach about purpose, and they often ask me, Firoz, I get all of this, but tell me, how the hell do I find purpose? And the reality is that nobody has found their purpose through a great joyful moment. It's always come through when human beings are going through deep pain. So pain and purpose are correlated, right from Buddha, right? I mean, Buddha was this great enlightened soul, but when did that journey start? When he saw pain. So I think pain and purpose is very closely correlated. And once you find your purpose, I think that leads to progress. Because purpose, you know, grounds you in action. You know, I always say that hope is not a course of action. When you find your purpose, you do stuff. And that's how you make progress. So my second, you know, probably big lesson is about correlation between pain, purpose, and progress. And the last one is on humility. As I said before, that, you know, a child humbles you in ways that no other experience can humble you. And the root cause of humility, and I was, you know, very, very fortunate that I got to meet Dr. Kalam, who, you know, I still remember when I spoke to him about my dream for, you know, an inclusive India. And then, you know, he listened very carefully for 30 minutes. And at the end of it, he just said one thing. This is such a beautiful mission. Make this your mission for life. That's it. He said, make this your mission for life. But every time I walked and met Dr. Kalam, Rashmi, and this is so profound, I looked at this man, and you know, like, I used to be very nervous every time I went and met him. And when I walked into the room, obviously I was nervous, and he would be sitting there. Then within minutes, I forgot that I was speaking to a former president. He would listen to me as if I was the president of the country, right? And it always amazed me, how is this man so incredibly humble? How is it even possible that you can be so humble, right? So I did spend a lot of time trying to understand just what makes a person humble. Because I've also met, you know, great CEOs and Nobel laureates whom I've, you know, achieved a great deal of success, but doesn't demonstrate the same level of humility. So I was like, what makes two very successful people, one incredibly humble and one not so humble and sometimes bordering on arrogance, right? So what is the difference? And I realized that the root cause of humility is to realize that you are never in control. That's the root cause of humility, because you should wake up and start believing that I can't control almost everything that happens in my life. And once you understand that, I think you naturally become humble, because you wake up and say, you know, this is all I can do. There's some things I just can't control. Maybe it goes back to, you know, what the Gita talks about, right? You know, how do you build equanimity in your life is to really not get overwhelmed or, you know, become too happy when success comes your way, or, you know, start feeling very sad when things don't go your way. To build that muscle memory of practicing, you know, humility and understanding that you're not in control of most of the outcomes in your life. You know, I think that is the root cause of peace eventually.
Exactly. Detached attachment is what I believe in. And I think it's really true. Yeah. Profound, Feroz, like always. And, you know, when you were talking all of this, I was only thinking of another quote that I'd read long back. Angela was the one who had written it. And she said, while we try to teach our children all about life, our children teach us what life is all about. And this was exactly what you so powerfully explained. Thank you so much for taking this journey. Thank you for contributing your uniqueness and individuality in all that you do. Thank you for sharing this special side of yours, the inspired dad side. All the best.
Thank you. It's still a work in progress, Rashmi.
With that, we come to the end of this weekly quest of You and I with Rashmi Shetty. Do let us know if you know people who make the world beautiful. Write in to rashmi.thethirdeye@gmail.com. That is rashmi.thethirdeye@gmail.com. Come, let's explore this amazing world together, both you and I.